Thank you, Dr. Skipper. You've certainly given me a lot to think about, and I'm sure that'll lead to some interesting discussions later. But before that, we've got four wonderful speakers now. Between them, they have a passion for the ethics of science in the past, the ethics of science now and in the future, ethical issues surrounding the changing information landscape that we live in, and the ethical dimensions of communicating science at a time when facts are not enough. Our first speaker is Wibul Piyawatanametha, who holds a doctorate in electrical engineering from UCLA and is currently director of the Advanced Imaging Research Center at King Mongkut Institute of Technology, Lat Krabang in Thailand. In 2010, he co-founded and served as an executive member of the Global Young Academy, and among other achievements, in 2013, he was selected by the World Economic Forum as one of the 40 top young scientists under 40, playing a transformational role in integrating scientific knowledge and technological innovation to improve the state of the world. Wibul, the floor is yours.
So give me a minute to try to find my presentation. So first of all, I would like to thank the organizer for inviting me to this prestigious forum here. I really enjoy the city and also the forum that we have today here. Today, I'm going to dive down not so much into the ethics, but to the science of science communication we are having an issue with big topics today. The pace of the scientific and technical progress and changes brought about by the fourth industrial revolution have been drastically changing the research and information landscapes. As society has access to more information and diverging opinions, it in turn has given rise to question and mistrust relevant to a host of science topics. Examples of those mistrust in scientific consensus are, firstly, go to the first one here, the GMO. In UK, it is dubbed as the Frankenstein food due to its unnatural creation, and it could cause so much harmful to the human being. But lots of scientific research have already proven or confirming that the GMO food is actually, when you're consuming it, it's not actually riskier than their non-GMO ones. Secondly, there are lots of concerns about deeply buried nuclear waste, as it can leak into underground water supply. Again, there's scientific consensus that this method is a good long-term solution to solve nuclear waste issue without future maintenance. Thirdly, HPV vaccination, which is actually directly close to my research here. The vaccine itself can help prevent majority of the cervical cancer cases, and yet not many people around the world are comfortable to send their daughters to get vaccinated. You can frame these topics in two ways. First, you can frame it as the vaccine which can help prevent cancers, or you can frame it as the vaccine that would lead to promiscuity. Fourthly, the climate change. It is a real deal, and we are the prime cause of it. And we have known about this issue for the longest time. Let me show you the research conducted by Exxon in 1982 on growth. It shows the data on growth of atmospheric carbon dioxide and average global temperature increase. The data indicating that by 2020, CO2 level in atmosphere would reach roughly around 420 ppm. And lo and behold, in May 2019, the measurement of 415 ppm is right within the predicted curve. Let me tell you another story from Thailand here, which is actually close to my heart. So in July, actually 2019, hemp was delisted from the controlled substance of the controlled substance list, and the extract of hemp flooded the market, and there was lots of advertisement of this as a magical drug that could treat every single disease. People and public trusted on that. There was a state, the director of the medical department of services had to come out and issue a state of emergency to stop this propaganda or news. And also prohibit the use of these extracts without doctor consultations. So why do general public disagree on this scientific consensus, even though scientists are claimed to be highly trusted? Figure from survey conducted by Pew Research Center in 2016 has shown that actually this is American data. So American trust in military and scientists is relatively high, of course, compared to the politician, which is down below at the bottom there, which is pretty common. You probably know that. But what to keep in mind is that the knowledge that we have learned through science, okay, ends up getting filtered through our preperceived beliefs, to our values, to our religious views, and to our ideologies, which is called the cultural cognition. It is what we have known for a long time in psychological term as the motivated reasoning. And therefore, every piece of scientific information may be fact-based or neutral, but it ends up getting interpreted by, but how we interpret the information is actually not. So, also, both legacy and new media continue to play a very influential role in translating very complex lines into 300 words or 30-second segments for public. Chances that a lot of have been lost in that translation, and we can't really complain as a science community that we are not. There are other voices on those channels. We have to also in those channels to attack those misinformation as well. Therefore, in this increasingly polarized world, how do we help disentangle all these problems? I have to say, there is an uneasy task, but perhaps an adoption of the code of ethics. Actually, this one I found it earlier in January, developed by World Economic Forum, could help actually guiding us and help entangle some of these issues that we have here. Some of those quotes are, let me read it out for you here. Engaging with the public and decision makers, pursuing the truth, minimizing harm, supporting diversity, being a mentor, and being accountable. Another ongoing effort to help grooming cultural scientists from really early age by getting them to participate in fun events such as the World Science Festival or Science Fest can help them to understand science better. Thailand has a very similar event held every year. It's called National Science Week. Over 1 million attendants every year they come to join the fair. And I'm coming from a group of young scientists community. We have a small session called Mythbusters. That the session itself help educate young generations about science facts and myths. Over 3,000 kids so far have actually participated in this event, and they are our new future to help attacking these entangled problems. To summarize, ethics in science communication is extremely and strictly important issues that we could help reduce this partisan, and we need to understand the art and science of science communication in order to get the public to trust in science, trust in the process of science, trust in good scientists who speak on their behalf. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd just like to add something there. Your data were from the States on trust, but if my memory serves me correctly, in Europe the picture is pretty much the same. The European Union has been doing surveys on public knowledge and opinions of science and technology for a long, long time. And what they show is that despite great efforts and increases in science communication, the same percentage of Europeans today think that the sun goes round the earth as did 30 years ago. So we're not actually changing their knowledge. But what we've got in common is that right at the top of the list come medical doctors, and the military doesn't appear on the European questionnaire, I don't think, followed by scientists in the public sector, followed by scientists in the private sector. Journalists, unfortunately, are way down near the bottom, and politicians are right at the bottom of the list. So it's the same, pretty much, on both sides. of the Atlantic. Now, we have another question coming up. I'm not going to comment to the question, but each of the speakers has posed a question for you to answer. So get your phones out and tell us whether you think that deeply burying nuclear waste is a good long-term solution to managing nuclear waste. And whilst we're doing that, I'd like to invite our second panelist onto the stage. Linda Nordling is, in her own words, a freelance journalist who writes about science, education, medicine and development, and the policies, politics and intersections between them. She's based in Cape Town, South Africa. Linda, please come to the stage.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. It is an honor to address such an audience in such company. As James just said in my introduction, I identify as a journalist, not as a science communicator. And the point I want to make, the point I want to make in this introductory statement is that those two terms don't mean the same thing, and they can't be used interchangeably. The other point I want to make is that there is a shift in power relations between the two notions that is throwing up ethical challenges that are relevant to this grouping in this room. Now, of course, science journalism is part of science communication. So is university public relations, children's science TV, scientist blogs, and I could go on. I've been a journalist for 17 years, four of them in the UK, the rest based in South Africa. In that time, much has changed in my profession. The internet and social media has kind of loosened our control as journalists over communication with the public. Newspapers and other media outlets are struggling to stay afloat. And in the US, a quarter of all newsroom jobs were lost between 2008 and 2018. Now, there's lots of statistics like that from all over the world. So this is happening everywhere. It's just that I found the statistic for America. Science journalism has suffered, as has many other specialist reporting areas. It's a difficult career, especially if you enjoy things like job security and the ability to one day retire. Now, before I kind of go on, this is not a cry for help. I'm doing fine. Maybe I don't need an intervention, but maybe science communication does. I want to share a personal anecdote with you that might set some context to what I just said. Earlier this year, I wrote an article for The Guardian, a UK newspaper. I haven't done so for quite some time, and they paid me 30 pence a word, so, a third of a pound, per word. It's how we paid, as hacks, we're paid per word. And it's the number that sticks in my mind because it's exactly what I was paid when I wrote for them over 10 years ago. I don't know about you, if you've enjoyed a pay rise in the last decade, good for you. There's a word for payments that don't keep up with inflation, and that's real term loss. Journalism has been a losing game for a while. It's hard to make a living, and many journalists move on to greener pastures, like public relations or corporate communications. It's often senior journalists that make this move, which means a loss of institutional wisdom at publications, and possibly one of the reasons that we're seeing an erosion of some of the credibility of the media and also some of the ethical standards in reporting. I don't know. All of this brings me to the next point I want to make, which is the rise of science PR, public relations. At the same time as science journalism has declined, science PR has flourished. This is partly for reasons that we have mentioned earlier, like the growing idea that science communication with the public is a vital job of the scientific establishment and it needs to be done. Gets a lot of resource. And also, I was reminded earlier during lunch that 70% of science is funded or done, I can't remember what it was, by the private sector. And obviously, they have corporate communications as a tradition there. This shift has been significant. And now, here comes an educated guess. But I think that in South Africa, where I live, there are more professional science writers employed by the University of Cape Town, one university, than are working in the country's entire press corps. And there are also many other platforms through which scientists these days can communicate with the public, other than through journalists. In addition to blogs and institutional websites, there are platforms like The Conversation, which offer researchers high-quality editorial assistance in writing op-ed and opinion in their subjects of expertise. These are shared on various media platforms, and they are often very good. But in my opinion, they are not journalism. I know there are people who disagree with this, and we can discuss that later. Again, I don't have numbers, but I think it's safe to say that these days, scientists and science PR writers are producing at least one order of magnitude more science content than working journalists. And some of this content, and now we're coming to the ethics, well, if we weren't there already, some of this content is making it into traditional media, and not always in ways that you notice. Only the other day, I was reading an article about Ebola and measles in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And it was only after reading about four paragraphs that I started to get the feeling that this is not written by journalists. So I scrolled down to the bottom of the article, and there it was, the disclaimer that says this is a piece written for The Conversation, The Conversation by this scientist. It was an excellent piece, but it didn't have what I was looking for and I was expecting, because I had approached it through a traditional, well, it's an online media platform, but it was there in amongst all the other news written by journalists, and it wasn't marked up top. Such uncertainty that besets you when you're reading news these days is partly a result of how we consume news these days compared with a few decades ago. Because if you open up a newspaper or Nature, you'll see, usually, if something is marked comment, op-ed, editorial, also based on where it is in the physical newspaper that you're holding in front of you. And even on news websites, you will also usually see on the front page, they will have a space for opinion, they will have a space for news, and so on. Some of the newer new media outlets don't always make those distinctions, but anyway. But that's not how we approach news these days. We don't go to, most of us don't go to The Guardian and read the news every day, although some people do. We click on links that we see on Facebook and on Twitter and on LinkedIn. And unless we look for it carefully, like I ended up doing, it can be really difficult to tell what has been written by journalists and what hasn't. And sometimes it's downright impossible. So in South Africa, and I'm not throwing South Africa under the bus on purpose, because this happens everywhere. It's just that I know South Africa. So in South Africa, it's quite common these days to see reputable, and I use that term increasingly more loosely, reputable news outlets publishing university press releases verbatim in their news pages under staff reporter, no balance comment. Nothing would tell you that this is written by a university press officer. This is sparking many ethical challenges and questions, which we will explore in the conversation later on. But the main one that I want to stress in my opening statement is that the boundaries of between science communication and PR and science journalism are becoming blurred in the eyes of the public, but also in the eyes of scientists. And this is what makes it, it's becoming more difficult for me to do my job, and I'll tell you how. So we always say that scientists don't want to talk to journalists. Fair. Quite often it's true, it can be tricky. But over the last 5 years, maybe, in South Africa, I have been met when I approach new scientists and I want their opinion on something, a paper they've written, or maybe they are in a position to comment on something that's going on with politically in the country. They come with these expectations. One of the expectations is that they can see what I've written before it's published. No. That is a tenet for many science publications, including Nature. You can't share copy before it's published, even for fact-checking. You can check facts, that's different, but you can't share copy. The other thing that scientists ask me these days is that they expect me to make them look good. And they expect me to tell them when they've said something stupid or something that could be misconstrued or something that might get them into trouble with their funders or with the Department of Science and Technology and so on. And I've been taken aback by this. You know, I've been in the game for 17 years. I've kind of seen most of it. But lately I have been surprised over and over again at what these scientists are expecting of me. And the only thing I can think that explains it is that many of these scientists are working with ex-journalists or people who are journalists and PR comms, because everyone's, you know, it's the gig economy, everyone's kind of doing a little bit of everything. And they're used to being able to treat those journalists or communicators that way. And so now they think that I am doing the same thing. But obviously, as a science journalist, as I identify myself, it is not my job to make anyone look good. If you tell me something stupid, I have full responsibility, possibly even, to expose it. And that's just part of the job. And so my closing statement after that kind of rant is that as science PR is becoming more powerful, because it is, you know, don't forget that I was talking about how science journalism and people like me are becoming fewer, it's important that we ask about the responsibilities of science PR and science professional communications, not just to its paymasters and to the scientists that these communications officers represent, but to society as a whole and to the integrity of science itself. Because it is all part and parcel of the same thing. And I'm going to end there and think we're going to move on, and then we can talk about it. and you can challenge me later. But thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Linda. As somebody who identifies as a science PR person, it might surprise you to hear that I agree with pretty much everything that Linda said. And although my job is to support CERN, and I do, and I think it is one of the most wonderful examples of what humanity is capable of, I love to see positive coverage of it in the media, but if I see my own words appearing in the media, words that I put into a press release, I don't trust that media anymore. I question what's happening everywhere else, and I question the quality of public discourse in a whole range of areas. So I think this is a very important point, and it's one that I see very clearly, because although I'm still working with the same people as I worked with 20 years ago, most of them are now in PR. 20 years ago, they might have been journalists. So this actually is something that's very important that's happening all around us right now. So Linda has a question, and I hope that will pop up on the screen whilst I introduce our next speaker, who is Angela Siney. Who I first came across when I picked up a book from the CERN bookshop called Inferior. And it's about women and science and the way that women's role in science, the way they've been portrayed in science. And if you haven't read it, I thoroughly recommend you to do so. It is a wonderful, wonderful book looking back into the history of science, the ethical implications of that, all the way back to Darwin. The amount of research that must have gone into it is breathtaking, and the complete lack of indignation that comes across in Angela's writing is very admirable. It makes her arguments all the stronger. So Angela is a British journalist. She's the author of three books, Geek Nation, which I haven't read yet, I have to do that, How Indian Science is Taking Over the World, Inferior, the one I just referred to, How Science Got Women Wrong, and the new research that's rewriting the story, and Superior, The Return of Race Science. She's also co-presenter of a recent BBC TV series on eugenics. So she's no stranger to science with strong ethical dimensions. Angela, please.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's an honour. Thank you to the World Science Forum for inviting me, and it was wonderful to hear from Magdalena and James and the other speakers. I'm watching in horror at this, that so many more people disagree with Linda than agree with her. I am a journalist, like Linda, and I should say at this point that journalists, our goal in life, our aim, this is why we do this, is to speak truth to power. That is our job. As science journalists, our job is to speak truth to the power of science, to the industry and establishment of science, to scientists themselves who have so much power over our everyday lives in how we understand ourselves. And if we don't have journalists challenging and taking this antagonistic role towards the sciences, it is intrinsically antagonistic in some ways, then who is ever going to check and be a check on what the scientists are doing? The reason I think this is so important is because when you don't have that check, then things go wrong. And we know throughout the history of science, and this is what my work really focuses on, that there have been huge mistakes that have been made by scientists and researchers, some of them catastrophic, not least this assumption, for example, that stood for many hundreds of years, that women were not the intellectual equals of men, which is one of the reasons that women weren't admitted to universities for a long time. Many universities weren't admitted to the scientific academies until the middle of the 20th century. That was a scientific, biological assumption that was imposed on women that then had a huge impact on how women were treated by society. And also on race. So my most recent book looks at race science, and for me, that is the perfect example of science gone wrong for a really long time. Here we have a body of work that posited that we are not one human species, that we are somehow different subspecies, that some people are more evolved than others, some groups are better than others, and that was used to justify this scientific assumption, which was reinforced by scientists throughout the 18th, 19th, and early 20th centuries, was then used to defend publicly and politically slavery and genocide, colonialism, apartheid, many of the worst atrocities of the last few hundred years. Scientists were part of that at every stage. It's only relatively recently that we've started to see a reckoning and an acknowledgement of just how terrible and brutal that history was. One of the wonderful movements I see happening around the world now is universities and institutions looking through their archives and starting to acknowledge that history, to look at that history, and admit that actually, yes, scientists were involved in terrible ideas, not just morally wrong, but scientifically fundamentally flawed, and that they were used to prop up the abuse and mistreatment and unequal treatment of people throughout the world. One of these recent efforts was made by the Max Planck Institutes, which we know are one of the biggest sets of one of the biggest employers of scientists in Germany. In its previous incarnation as the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, there were scientists there, prominent scientists, who were actively involved in the Nazi regime's efforts around the Holocaust, who aided the regime in a very deliberate, conscious way. So my argument is, and I think there are many more examples, there are still mistakes being made now, there are still scientists who are not motivated necessarily by the pursuit of truth, but by other factors such as funding or personal prejudice or politics or whatever it may be. And that is what we need science journalism for, to make sure that someone is there watching what they are doing in the same way that political journalists watch what the politicians are doing. Now, for me, I was asked by James to think of a question, and there are two things I think that could really directly address the issues around ethics and mistakes that we see happening in science even now. One, I think, is for all scientists, at whatever level they are, whether it's the undergraduate level or whether older, to have a very thorough training in the history and context of the fields that they're studying. I'm quite shocked sometimes that in the UK, I studied engineering, and in the entire 4 years of my degree, I was only expected to write one essay on ethics, and I actually didn't get any training in that. I was just expected to do it, as though it should be able to come off the top of my head. It's just not good enough. When we understand the history of our fields, then we are less likely to repeat the mistakes that have been made before. And I still see scientists now repeating mistakes that have been made before, invoking ideas that are reminiscent of eugenics, or repeating tropes that should have died a very long time ago, dangerous ideas that should have died a very long time ago. But because they are completely ignorant of the history of their fields and of the context in which they sit, the political context in which they sit, they're completely unaware of what they're writing and how it can be misconstrued. The one surefire way to make sure that research is not misappropriated is to be cognizant of all the different ways in which it can be interpreted by the outside world. So that includes the history and the context. I would like to see that kind of training, not at a superficial level, but at a very deep level throughout every scientist's training and at the school level when we study the sciences. The second thing I would like to see is at an institutional level within universities and scientific, private and public institutions, is accountability. So science at the moment is just starting to go through its own Me Too moment. A few scientists in the US have been brought to book for sexual harassment and bullying. That, I think, will continue. In fact, I think we'll see many more cases of that in the future as more people feel brave enough to speak up. What we need from universities and institutions is accountability. When these cases are brought against people, very often what happens is the victims, who tend to be junior, are the ones that end up leaving. Because the person who is senior, often very powerful, the person who brings in the funding, who is there to kind of be the face of the institution, is seen as untouchable. And we have to lose that. We cannot continue, as we have for so long within the sciences, treating scientists as though their work is completely separate from the person that they are. Those kind of standards do not apply to any other part of public life. You cannot work in a bank or in politics and be a terrible person morally and yet still continue doing your work. And I don't believe that scientists should also be able to get away with that. So if we have accountability and we hold scientists in their personal and public lives to the same moral and ethical standards that we hold other people in public life, I think it would be better for all of us. The question that I wanted to posit then, given these two things, I can only pick one, is historical education. I think if we understand history and how the world came to look the way it does, how our institutions of science, our establishments came to look the way they do, and then we can start to understand some of the inequalities and how the inequalities work, I think that would be useful for all of us. And that includes not just history, but also the social sciences. There is a degree of snobbery, I think, within the sciences and engineering towards the social sciences because they're seen somehow as softer or less rigorous. The social sciences are the ones doing the work here that help us understand and put what scientists do in context, who hold it to account. And that includes gender studies. If we didn't have gender studies, then trust me, there would be a large body of work within biology that would still be telling us that women are intellectual inferiors. So we need the social sciences to back up and support the social sciences, and we need the sciences to support and back up what social scientists do. Thank you.
Thank you. So if we could have Angela's question on Slido, get ready to vote one more time. And I'd like to invite our last speaker to the stage. Matthew Liao is an ethicist from New York University who I first met when we invited him to come and give a talk at CERN, at a TEDx CERN, about ethics in neurotechnology. And I remember, this was in 2015, I think, and I remember having a conversation about the ethics of self-driving cars, which were still way off in the future, and who's responsible when things go wrong, and so on and so forth. And that had never have occurred to me back then, but I've been reminded of it on many occasions since then. So I'm very much looking forward to your talk, Matthew. Please come to the stage.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. So first of all, I just want to thank the World Science Forum for having me here and James for inviting me. So I'm an ethicist. I'm a moral philosopher, as James has mentioned. And so I just thought I would take this opportunity to tell you how I think about the ethics of science communication and sort of ethics generally. So as a philosopher, so there are sort of different ways to do ethics. And philosophers don't own ethics. Ethics is the responsibility of everybody. As a philosopher, so, you know, I sort of teach students in medical ethics, and at medical schools, I talk to scientists. And there's sort of one way of doing ethics, which is, you know, you might dub it as checklist ethics. Like, did I have informed consent? Check, right? Is there a conflict of interest? Check, right? And the way I do ethics is slightly different from the checklist ethics. And it's seeking, basically, my goal is to try to aim for moral understanding. I think that's really important because the issues that we face are going to change, right? But if we teach our scientists, if we teach our students how to think, how to gain moral understanding, they can adapt to different problems. And I think that's really, really important. So that's what I try to convey in my teaching. And so rather than, for the rest of my presentation, I thought I'd give you an example of sort of rather than just tell you what I do, I'll show you how I think about this. And so I'm going to use the ethics of AI in healthcare as an example. I have a book coming out with Oxford University Press next year on the ethics of artificial intelligence, and I also organized a conference on the ethics of AI. So here's some remarks here. So we know that AI is getting really, really impressive. So here's an example of IBM's Watson beating two of the best Jeopardy players in the world. And here's the Google DeepMind. So, you know, very, you know, beating the Lee Sedol, who was the world's one of the best players in Go a couple years ago. And then a year later, DeepMind developed something called AlphaGo Zero, which is sort of, it's unsupervised. It just sort of learned how to play Go on its own without any inputs from human being. And that program beat the program that beat Lee Sedol, basically 100-0. So it just sort of, it crushed that program. And then the program has now been applied to chess, to many other applications. So in healthcare, there's also sort of machine learning and deep learning is also being applied to healthcare. So this is an example of sort of AI being used to detect sort of tumor cells. And it's also being used to detect irregular heartbeats, diseases, eye diseases. It's been used in fertility clinics to figure out whether an embryo is going to be viable. And also, natural language processing is being used to sort of figure out whether someone might be suicidal through their sort of texts. And so the promise of AI, it's really exciting. You know, it's going to improve medical diagnosis, reduce medical error, eliminate unnecessary medical tests, enable doctors to spend more time with their patients. It's going to lead to sort of better drug discovery. We're going to be able to use machine learning to sort of figure out sort of proteins and sort of chemical compounds that we haven't discovered before. And potentially, it's going to reduce healthcare costs. So I'm coming from the U.S., where U.S. spends about $3.5 trillion per year on healthcare, which is exorbitant. And so, possibly by reducing administrative costs and other costs, we could sort of bring down some of those healthcare costs. Okay, so before we talk about, sort of before we roll out the ethics of sort of AI into healthcare, I think we need to think about the ethics. So how do I think about the ethics? The first thing I do is I sort of try to gain an understanding of the technologies, the science involved in sort of machine learning. And I'm sure there are many of you in this room who are more experts than I am, so I'm going to go over this very briefly so that I can get to the ethics. So in machine learning is basically this the ability of algorithms to sort of learn on its own, right? And they're there's something called supervised learning, and there's something called unsupervised learning, and there's reinforcement learning. So supervised learning is where you sort of train your algorithm, you teach it, you sort of label different data for it, and then through the algorithm, then sort of through your labeling, learns how to classify certain things. Then there's sort of unsupervised learning, where the algorithm itself sort of starts to cluster different things on its own. And then through that, it gets better and better. And there's something called, so this is the supervised learning and the unsupervised learning. And then there's something called reinforcement learning. And that's where basically you reward the algorithm for getting something right, and you punish the algorithm for getting something wrong. And through that way, it sort of gets better and better. And there's something else called deep learning, which is basically a neural network with a bunch of different layers. And this is what sort of many of the breakthroughs in AI right now is through deep learning, sort of a combination of deep learning and reinforcement learning and so on and so forth. And what it does is that it basically has a bunch of layers. And through adjusting those nodes, it gets better and better at figuring out what it's trying to do, the task that it's given. Okay, so what are some of the problems with the ethics of AI? Well, one big problem is that it needs a lot of data, right? So we just learned, for example, that Google has been sort of buying healthcare data, right? It needs a lot of data and raises questions about privacy. Here's another problem, which is that it's the garbage in, garbage out problem. You can have the perfect algorithm, but if you have bad data, then you're gonna get bad results. And a very prominent example is sort of in healthcare, right? So a lot of the data on healthcare, sort of in clinical subjects, were white male, and they ignored the women. And so it turns out that the dosing was completely off in many cases when it's applied to women. So another issue with sort of machine learning is when you have good data, but if you have bad algorithms, you're gonna still get bad results. So you have overfitting problems, underfitting problems, and so on and so forth. So that's something that we need to keep in mind as we, you know, as computer scientists develop algorithms. And then there's sort of this new, this is exacerbated by deep learning, right? Because it's basically these neural networks, and even researchers themselves have no idea what's going on with these deep learning, because they can be really complex. There can be millions of nodes in there. And so that raises questions about interpretability, explainability, and trust. So here's, so this says, this is your machine learning system. Yep, you pour data into this big pile of linear algebra and then collect the answers on the other side. What if the answers are wrong? Well, just stir the pile until they start looking right. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of close to what, you know, that's what's happening in many cases. Okay, so here you might think, well, look, if the deep learning is just, if these machine learning, if they're just getting the cases right, who cares? Like, if it's accurate, who cares about interpretability? Who cares about explainability? And so I just want to, there are a lot of things to say here, but I'll give you one thought here. It turns out that it's not so simple. There's something called generative adversarial networks. And so one example of this is sort of, so these deep learning systems are really good at classifying images. But it turns out that if you take one pixel and you just turn it from black to white, it'll totally misclassify the image. So if you look at the top left, that's supposed to be a ship. But you just take one pixel and you turn it into white, now classifies it as a car with 99.7% confidence, right? And this has been replicated also naturally. It's called the one pixel attack. And here's another even scarier example. So it's the panda. So you see on the top of the panda. And then the researchers were able to apply some sort of filter through it, and it's totally imperceptible, right? The resulting image is still a panda to us, right? But for the machine learning, they classify as a gibbon with 99.3% confidence. And so these are the type of algorithms we're now deploying in the wild. We're sort of using it in healthcare, we're using it for self-driving cars, we're using it for autonomous weapons, and we just, you know, as an ethicist, I cringe. You know, I think this is really scary. We need a better way of sort of dealing with these algorithms. We can't just sort of have these type of algorithms running around in the wild. So I just want to leave you with the thought. So this is a self-driving car. It sort of got into the accident in Arizona. So what should we do? What should we do about the problem of sort of machine learning and sort of this deep problem where the machine learning algorithms are not learning the underlying structure, the deep causal structures of the world? Okay, so it turns out that we might have a framework for dealing with this. So in the case of drug discovery, right, we have a whole set of clinical trials, at least in the US, there's sort of the four phases, you know, you test it for safety, you test it for, test it for efficacy, and so on and so forth. Should we have something similar in the case of algorithms, especially novel algorithms that are gonna affect people's well-being? It seems like we shouldn't just let companies take these algorithms and just you know, test them on streets. Like maybe we should sort of slow it down and sort of do sort of clinical trials like with these algorithms. I mean, the downside of that is, of course, that the innovation is going to slow down a little bit. So that's a trade-off, but it's a trade-off that I think we have to decide, because right now, as I've, you know, if you, you know, with the generative adversarial network and all these other things, you can see that there are a lot of algorithms that are not really safe to be used. Thank you very much.
So we now have about 35 minutes for discussions, but I'm going to ask you to vote one more time before you do that. Matthew's question, and whilst you're doing that, I'd like to invite everybody to come back to the stage, please, and take a seat. Please. So should we regulate novel algorithms the way we regulate novel drugs? There we go. Now, I might, depending on how time goes, I might ask you to vote on some of these questions again at the end, because I think it'll be interesting to see if we manage to sway your opinions in the next 35, 40 minutes or so. So before I throw the questions open to the floor, I'm going to use moderator's prerogative and ask a question of my own to each of our speakers, and then it'll be up to you. So I'll start with Magdalena, and thanks for what I found to be a very fascinating and eye-opening insight into the workings of nature. I'm sure that I learned a lot. I'm sure everybody learns a lot about that here. But one thing you didn't mention is the important role played by the Nature press release in the, what science gets consumed by consumers around the world globally. Now, Nature puts out a press release that's considered to be a primary source by a lot of journalists around the world. It's very influential. Getting into that press release is like gold dust for people like me, because you know that guarantees you coverage. But what's the ethical responsibility of having such a big role in the science that gets consumed further downstream from Nature?
Thank you. Thank you for this question. I mean, the role, of course, that these press releases from Nature, but any press release, actually, is really important and has to be taken with great care. There were some really interesting comments made earlier about the blurring boundary between journalism and PR and some associated issues. So I can tell you from working closely with our press officers that it's a responsibility that they take very, very seriously. It's really interesting to see that on occasion, and I can think of one specific example which will probably make you laugh because many of you will recognize it, but on occasion there are nuances of a study which are left off, for example, from the title of a study or even the abstract. Usually it's in the abstract, but it may not appear in the title. Nevertheless, a detail which is instrumental to the degree with which you can interpret a study, those details are emphasized in a press release because it's so important for us to bring it to the fore. And often it's our press office who will actually prod and poke the authors and the editors to bring out all of the context so that when the reporting is done, it can be immediately the journalists who read the press release have as much context, as much of a balance as possible. And so the example I'm thinking of is, you know, if a study is done in mice or in humans, right? It's a biomedically relevant study. So we endeavor for most of these studies to say in the title that they're not done in humans. On occasion, that gets left out for various reasons, but that's one of the examples that always gets brought up in a press release. Really important ethical considerations, but even more broadly speaking, the responsibility and that accountability that also Angela spoke about in the context of press releases, I think is very important. If I may just add one more comment, one interesting thing that I know my colleagues who work in the press office are very concerned about, especially in the context of biomedical studies, is the prevalence of journalists reporting on preprints. Because, of course, not only are they not peer-reviewed, but they also take information straight from, effectively, a draft of a scientific paper. And so our press officers talk about it a lot, actually, and that concerns them hugely.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, archive has a big role to play in that phenomenon as well. I don't want to monopolise the conversation, so I'm going to move straight on to Wibul. And my question for you is very simple. Why the question that you chose to ask the audience?
I guess in a way it's very controversial. It has been the debate for the past 30, 40 years now, whether these deposits are going to be stable enough for these waste actually to actually remain intact there. But actually, the fact is that if you do just a simple Google search, you can find that there's evidence on why scientists are actually proposing the way it is now, because it's actually there's a place in Gabon that actually is a place that there's a natural nuclear fission, right? Constantly doing it for the past 2 billion years, okay, deep under the ground. And we as a scientist did not do any, well, we did the calculation, of course, and doing the simulation, but it's not as good as this evidence base there, that it remains there, all the remnants of the decaying would not leak out to the underground, whatever things there. So that's why there are lots of public confusion about this, as you can see that not many people are still accepting that, right? I mean, you can see, but it's the most safe way that we actually can do it, the safest way to do it. Thank you.
I think that's a very interesting question. It reminds me of a comment by another TEDx CERN speaker, actually, who was a plant geneticist who was working on genetic modification for drought resistance in food crops, which might be useful. And she said that it's a worrying world where society is resistant to the very technology that it needs to survive, actually. So these questions, I think, how we get them out there, but it's important. Linda, I didn't see what the final vote was, but the last time I looked at it, it was like the British referendum in 2016. It was like 52-48 or something like that, but it was very finely balanced. So maybe you'd like to explain why people can't vet your copy a little bit more.
Why can't they? So imagine I had interviewed Boris Johnson as a journalist for The Times. Would you be comfortable if I sent it to him for fact-checking before publication? Probably not. Scientists, when I say this to them, they say, but it's not the same thing. My work has been peer-reviewed. What could you possibly do? You know, it's been verified. And it's a basic tenet of journalism. I think what maybe some journalists, some scientists don't understand is that there's a decision to be made. What do you value more? Do you value accuracy to the point that you will give up independence? Because we do make mistakes. I'm not gonna, I make mistakes all the time. Most of them quite innocuous, misspelling someone's name. But in journalism, I think the underlying assumption is that those mistakes are worth it, because the importance of the journalistic integrity and being able to not be influenced by the person you're writing about supersedes that issue.
Thank you. Angela, you wrote one more essay on ethics as a student than I did. So we did none at all. And I very much hear you, and I agree that people should learn about the history. But I was thinking when you were speaking about, in the physical sciences, There's a perception that it's more solid, it's less clear, less is subject to perception. Do you think this is true across all the sciences?
I think what it comes down to is, do we feel that science is objective always? And I would say that although for me science is one of the best ways we have of understanding the universe and understanding ourselves, and we strive for objectivity, we are still humans at the end of the day, and we're fallible, and so we're going to make mistakes. In fact, mistakes are part of the process, because you make a mistake, then you correct it, and then you move on. And when you're aware of your biases and your prejudices, you can also account for them. The dangers that I see are when scientists believe themselves to be perfectly objective when they're not. And then, if they believe that, then they don't take into account their prejudices and their biases, and so they just reproduce them. So the mistakes then just continue. So I think what a social scientific and a historical education gives you is the ability to recognize your prejudices and your biases. It's kind of fundamental in that way. So in my case, I studied engineering, and like I said, right the way through my degree, I thought, you know, I'm just dealing with maths and physics and numbers. How, you know, in what way can this be at all tainted by bias and prejudice? Well, when I was working at the BBC, I did a degree in my spare time at the Department of War Studies at King's College London, where I studied weaponry, security, international security, so the way that weapons work and the technology around it. And you can see then that these are technologies that come out of the world of physics and maths and engineering, and the way that they are developed and applied and used is deeply coloured by the politics. They're deeply coloured even by feminism. I mean, there's an entire body of literature looking at the phallic nature of weapons. So there are so many layers to the way that we develop the systems of knowledge that we have and the way that we think about things. And I think a purely kind of science-based or just maths-based or physics-based education doesn't give you all of that.
Okay, and then finally, Matthew, how far do you think we are from addressing the kind of ethical issues? It came up in a session this morning, actually, that the ethicists, why do you always come to us late? Mm-hmm. So are we actually addressing the ethical issues that we need to address for the kind of sciences that you're looking into today?
So the short answer is sometimes not quickly enough. I think we do, ethicists need to be much more proactive in anticipating and addressing the issues that arise. But the other thing I want to say is that I think it's sort of advantageous for scientists to work with ethicists. And part of the reason is that I think there's a sort of a panel on funding. If you do ethics that aren't, if you do science that's unethical, that can really set back funding for the whole area for quite a long time. So let me just give an example. I mean, there's the gene editing, sort of the doctor from China who sort of gene edited babies. And that was unethical for several reasons. First of all, it was sort of unnecessary, right? He was trying to get rid of HIV from the babies, try to give HIV immunity to the babies. But the problem is that he did something called sperm washing. So once you wash the sperm, the chance of the babies getting sort of HIV is basically zero. And so there's absolutely, there's no ethical like imperative to do this procedure anymore. So it's just basically imposing risk on the embryos. And then the other is just that the science is not quite there yet. So there are problems with off-target editing and issues like that we just haven't resolved yet. So for him to be doing something like that, that's sort of unethical for that reason. But then, the result of it is now a lot of people are talking about moratoriums on sort of gene editing and so on and so forth. Research funding, people are scared to sort of fund research in this area. And that could be very problematic because we do, my personal view is that gene editing has to go forward. There are sort of a lot of things we need to figure out. There are a lot of diseases. There are a lot of issues that we need to deal with, and we need to sort of figure out the process of gene editing. And so by working with ethicists, by making sure that your science is ethical, I think that can sort of really, they can work together and sort of facilitate science.
So I'd like to open up to the floor now. I think there are microphones in the room, so let's take some questions. There are lots of hands. Let's start with one at the front and one at the back. So maybe one here and one there. Yes, they're there in the middle. Let's go. And maybe we'll take a couple of questions, and then we'll get the answers, and then we'll do another round and keep going until we run out of time. So, please.
I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, because my hearing is so bad that I couldn't understand the lectures. Please excuse me. I want to tell about ethics in publication. It's a short story. 30 years ago, I invented a new chemical synthesis. This made possible to make millions of new compounds that can be used in, for example, in drug research. Today, this method is applied at the big pharmaceutical companies, and even hundreds of billions of new compounds, or even trillions of new compounds are prepared and tested in a single process. I published the method long ago, and it was a painful experience for me that the editor-in-chief of the journal and all the three reviewers expropriated it. Then I have to tell that all these people filed patent applications, and two papers were published in Nature. I sent a correction letter to Nature, but it was rejected by Dr. Maddox, at that time the editor-in-chief of the journal. It was, again, a very painful experience, because this, in fact, protected the guilty. And this continued over the years. And in this year, I subjected again a manuscript, a short manuscript, to Nature, but because I thought that his things has changed over the years. But the result was, again, rejection. But it was not Dr. Scripper who refused it. The editor-in-chief who is responsible for that is now the member of the ethical committee of the American Chemical Society. You imagine that? And another person is a distinguished professor at the University of California, Park Davis. And what remained for me are the hundreds of unslept nights and the possibility to publish the story at the Predator journals. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I'm not sure we can ask Magdalena Skipper to respond unless you want to, because it's very historical and it's a very specific case, and I wouldn't expect you to have that in your head right now, but it's an interesting story, and I'm sure we can all learn from it. So can we take the next question, please?
Thank you very much. My name is Konin Shemireire. I'm from the Global Young Academy, and very enlightening talks, ladies and gentlemen. I'd only want to know from any of you regarding our theme, science, ethics, and responsibility, and focusing on responsibility in particular, what your thoughts are on the responsibility of scientists to communicate their science to the public. Because I really appreciate that, of course, journalists keep us honest and do a professional job, but we are increasingly being asked to communicate better with the public and so on. So what are your thoughts on this?
Can we take one more, and then we'll come to you, and then we'll answer these two?
Okay, I actually would like to add an ethical issue here.
Okay.
And this is to the AI. It takes to train one algorithm, it produces as much CO2 as 5 cars produce in their lifetime. What is the problem for the ethicist here and scientists?
Okay, so we have two questions. I don't know, the responsibility of scientists. Would anyone like to comment on the responsibility of scientists to communicate their work?
Since I have the microphone. So my position on this is that I always encourage scientists to communicate the science to the general public. And the simplest reason I give for this is actually what we heard at the very beginning of the session. The general public trusts scientists as a profession. And so if we want to engage general public in science, want them to trust in facts again, then why don't we capitalize on that trust that the general public has for that profession and therefore communicate the work that we, you, active scientists, do? So that's my position on it.
And for me, actually, I'm not a science communicator by professional. I'm a full professor in biomedical engineering. But I foresee that in my home country, Thailand, we don't have such a great science communicator. And I see some of the articles that are coming out from, sorry to say, the science communicator as a job. It didn't come out right, and I feel very frustrated. So 10 years ago, actually, I dived now into this field and tried to translate lots of difficult subjects and publish into, you know, scientific basic newspaper or some local languages so that they can actually understand better. So I feel it's my responsibility, even though I do so much work in, let's say, cancer research and also deep learning as well, but I see it necessary for future generation to understand science better, because I've seen so many bad things happen to my own country. I want them to use science as the holy grail to guide them to anywhere that they can go. Thank you.
Thanks. I don't know anything about self or algorithms and CO2, so I'm going to pass that up the line. Connie, on your question to do with should scientists communicate their science. So again, I have a fairly narrow point to make on this, which is to do with talking to journalists. And it seems to me sometimes that scientists think that it's optional to answer questions about their research that has been publicly funded. And I think that is not a tenable stance to have if your research is funded by taxpayers' money. Then you have a duty to answer when I call you, and you can always say, look, I don't want to talk about it, but you better have a good reason.
I think I agree. It's so important, I think, for scientists to engage with the public, especially now in an age of misinformation and disinformation, when lies spread faster on the internet than the truth. I think more scientists than ever have a responsibility to counter that tide of bad science with good science. One of the problems, I think, and I share this kind of concern with Linda, is that every scientist thinks that they have the monopoly on the facts. And very often I will speak to scientists in the same field who disagree with each other, who try very hard to convince me that they are the ones who are correct and not the other person. And, you know, that's where then outside people like us come in, I think, to negotiate that. And I think it's important then for the public to understand that when a scientist is communicating with them, to sometimes treat that with a critical lens, as you would anything that you, any kind of media that you consume, I would say, treat with a critical lens, but also understand that scientists don't always agree.
Yeah, so as an academic, I started feeling that I needed to sort of talk to journalists, because I felt that, you know, if I didn't do it, then maybe some of the reportings, they don't get reported correctly. And so it was my responsibility to just sort of contribute as much as I can to making sure that sort of there's sort of proper knowledge being disseminated in the public. I also want to address the question about climate change. That's a really big problem about how sort of it turns out that machine learning and sort of these machines are using up a lot of sort of greenhouse. They're taking up a lot of carbon footprint. So what should we do about that? I actually gave 4 talks last week in Spain about climate change and what we should do about that. Happy to talk to you afterwards. But very quickly, I think, at the end of the day, what we should aim for is some sort of net reduction in carbon footprint. And you might think that deep learning or sort of these techniques could enable us to get there in the long term. And so it's not so much about, I mean, there's sort of things like Bitcoins where it's just taking up so much energy, it's not clear whether it's doing the planet any good. But then there's so sort of basic research where researchers, maybe at CERN or other places, they're doing basic research that are really important, and that requires these type of energy. So I wouldn't want a society where we sort of stop that right away and then the research couldn't go on. But I think that being cognizant of the issue is very important. So thank you.
Thanks. So just another comment to the question about responsibility. Should scientists communicate? I think science should. And I think that some scientists have an aptitude for it, some don't. Some have a wish to do it, some don't. But those who do it, who have the aptitude or wish to, should be trained, and it should be recognized in their career structures as something positive for science, which very often is not the case. But that's another topic altogether. There are two microphones in the room, so we'll take one here and one here, and then we'll just redistribute the microphones then. So you two next, but let's start here.
Thank you for the very interesting talk. I wanted to come back to the question that you asked, you know, for scientists to be vetting a journalist's content. So I'm an astrophysicist working in the exoplanet field. So from time to time, we have like a planet in the habitable zone that we discover. And what we have to fight against is a bit of the sensationalism from the journalists, which want to say, oh yeah, we discovered life. And so personally, I like to be able to vet the articles that journalists write to fight against that. Because then, okay, the facts are less sexy, but they are more scientifically accurate. So, you know, it's a balance. And so I wanted to know your opinion on that. Thank you.
Okay. We'll take another question from the back.
Yeah, Jan Helge Solbakk, University of Oslo. And my comment and question is directed to the two science journalists. I very much liked your self-definition of speaking truth to power. And I presume also that you have as a vision to speak truth to people. You mentioned the Me Too problem also in academia. What puzzles me is that, as far as I know, no science journalist have addressed the forms of harassment that is much more prevalent in academia than sexual harassment, that is intellectual harassment. The first speaker or the keynote speaker, she was mentioning the issue of co-authorship. Some years ago, I introduced a word, new word, co-authorshipping. We know that when we talk about the prevalence of scientific misconduct, the problem, the kind of misconduct that is steadily rising, is co-authorshipping. Just to mention two examples. Science, I think it was the September issue, one of the September issues in 2015. It was an article with 50 co-authors tracing the origin of the last big Ebola outbreak. Five of the co-authors deceased, died before the article was published. Four of them, local people who were infected during the process of gathering samples. The fifth died from a stroke. In the article, it stated all co-authors, 50 co-authors, contributed the same. But in spite of that, the first and the last author were both professors from Harvard. Second example, when the vice president of one big university is co-author on 18 papers from 2018 till 19, that is the same time that person has been the second in command of a huge university. The person is interviewed, he's proud of what he has done, and he says, yes, my responsibility is to indicate the direction. And nobody comments on this. When are you really going to go into speaking truth to power? We talk about globalization in academia also. Now, more and more young researchers come from poor and low-income countries to rich universities, and these forms of intellectual harassment is steadily increasing. This is the real Me Too in academia.
Two questions there to address. So, shall we start with sensationalism in journalism and then go on to that? Would you like to just...
So that's a great question, and I'll start. I mean, I'm sure Magdalena and Angela would like to weigh in as well if they... I don't think that we will curb sensationalism and the drive and the factors that drive sensationalism in journalism and in reporting by introducing copy vetting. I find that the newspapers or journalists, maybe let's put like myself, who get asked to vet copy, or if I will share copy, we tend not to be the ones that perpetrate that. I mean, I'll sensationalize for a given value of, you know, you always want it to be a little bit exciting, but obviously we want to communicate truth. And so I think the publications that maybe are doing this, and I could be wrong, I mean, I'm speaking from an Anglo-Saxon kind of background in journalism. I don't know what's going on in other countries. I think that the publications that sensationalize to the point of grave misinformation are quite difficult to police in that way. And I'm not sure that it's possibly not even in their interest to check their facts. I don't know if you saw the other day, there was apparently a scientist in Ohio who says that he's found insects on Mars. I don't know if you've seen this. This is the kind of story that went around. And there was a press release that was sent around, and then it was picked up by the Daily Mail, which did, 3,000 words with pictures and not a single comment from another scientist. So I'm not sure the people who write those articles will be the people who would, even if we're agreeing that we should share copy, vet copy, I'm not sure that you will reach them anywhere because they're probably not the science journalists. Maybe I'm wrong in your, maybe it's a Anglo-Saxon point of view, but that was a very convoluted answer to your question, and I'm not sure I answered it.
I think if I could just add to that, I think you can discuss boundary conditions with a journalist before, and I think that's perfectly reasonable to do, and that happens quite often. I think, Magdalene, you wanted to comment on the other point?
I was just going to say on both these things, firstly, that, of course, we're also in the business of selling newspapers and magazines, so we have to have a story, which is why we're doing it in the first place. If you take that top line away, then it's less likely to get published at all. And this is part of the reason why scientists themselves and press offices hype up stories to such a great degree. That's not to say we don't get things wrong. Of course, scientists sometimes overstep the mark. But again, the answer to that is not copy-checking. It is a scientist saying quite clearly, may I just say that this does not mean this. And if you make that very clear to the journalist, then they will know. You don't need to have a look at the copy to impress that upon them necessarily. And it certainly then doesn't...
No.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't cross ethical boundaries. And on the other question, I mean, I wouldn't like to get into a game of saying which form of harassment is worse than another, because just because sexual harassment is not a big issue for you, that doesn't mean it isn't for the person who's getting sexually harassed. But I think it's all about power. It's about how power gets exercised in these spaces and in these communities. And there is no doubt that there are senior professors, senior scientists who exercise their power in many different ways. Sometimes it's sexual harassment, sometimes it's bullying, sometimes it's in that form of intellectual control and putting their stamp on things or taking credit, which also senior scientists have done disproportionately for work that they haven't done over the years. And scientists and journalists have reported on this. We have. That's not to say we can report on every single thing. In that case, we would need the other co-authors to tell us that they felt that they had not been given the right amount of credit. And if they're not telling us, then how can we report on it? Because we haven't been in the lab the whole time. So how are we supposed to know who did what? So we rely on whistleblowers in that sense. And that is the same in the Me Too movement as anything else. We rely on whistleblowers. If you have issues, please come to us, and then we can investigate.
So thank you for that comment about effectively ethics of authorship. I mean, you put it very dramatically as intellectual harassment, which I found an interesting turn of phrase. I think ethics of authorship are really, really interesting. Increasingly, I mentioned citizen scientists as being authors. Think back to the time when there were all sorts of contributions to scientific papers that were not contributed at all. We can all think about scientific colonialism, for example. Data collected in some countries, used by researchers in other countries without even an acknowledgement, let alone authorship on those papers. I think this is a very important issue. I agree with Angela that we, and by we, I mean, for example, also journalists on Nature, touch on these topics. It's very important for us also as editors to know this. It's important for the institutions to know this, because institutions are the ones who are actually probably the most empowered. Of course, they can be shamed publicly into doing something, but locally, I think that's really important to raise. And I just want to make, speaking of sensationalism, I just want to make a sensational statement. If you think about the way that academic science is structured, it's kind of structured like medieval apprenticeship. If you work in someone's lab, if you don't have support from outside of that lab, you're actually powerless, which creates these situations of potential harassment and exploitation, be it associated with, you know, bullying, things that lead to mental health issues, exploitation of authorship, and so on. I'm just going to make that over-dramatic comparison. But it's interesting to compare that to other contexts in which people work, individuals work, where I think they have more support than in academic setting where research often is done.
Thank you. So there were two questions at the front. There's a microphone there. There were two questions in the middle, and there are still hands going up all over the place, and we're really running out of time. So I'd like to ask you to frame your questions very quickly, and then I'll ask the indulgence of the organizers to let us overrun by a few minutes.
You have already decided what you want me to say. How long I want to say it. It's important to let me frame the way I feel it. Communications in science and science journalism is completely different. Communications seem to be self-serving. An institution like you work for, you have a communication. A discovery comes out. They tell this communication guy, go and say how it is related, how good we did, what we did. But if a journalist comes from outside, will ask more questions. How did you do it? How much money did you put in? How the government money went into it? Yesterday, Stephanie gave a presentation on the issue of funding on this drug discovery. And you realize that a drug is discovered, they put a lot of money from the government. When it comes out, it's so expensive. Because why? Everybody will say, oh, you did a very good job. We did this research, we did this and that. Because there is no journalist who came around and asked some of the questions, investigative reporting, questions. These things is missing completely. So I would like to, science communication has become like the weatherman or weatherwoman. They come and say, we do this, and that. This is what we produce. This is how good we are. But how did we do it? Relevance, funding, this issue should be at the center of communicating science and leading with the society, with the people. I'm going to finish by just doing a comment. Personal comment, if you allow me. I was a Rwandan Minister of Education and Science in 2001 to 2009. And in 2005, I met with the editor-in-chief of Nature. They wanted to support the Rwanda for science education. So in 2005-06, I think, they sent Linda to Kigali. And she came to my office, and then we discussed, and I took her to the field, and she went there, and she wrote a report. I think it was an investigative report. She went there and looked at the school and returned back. And the project has been going on for many years, since 2006, 7, until I think I thought 2013 and 14. I was looking at the website. Actually, you know, you could see that this project started in manufacturing equipment in a secondary school in a rural Rwanda with people in UK, came very important because probably when she returned back, she did a good investigative report. So a journalist, science journalist, is very important in that sense. Thank you.
I think we can all agree with that, actually. And even from the corporate communication side, which I represent, I also believe that you need people holding up mirrors to us and investigating what we are doing. Absolutely. Next question, please.
Hello, I'm Dr. Anupama Hawk, and I come from the rest of the world. Very quickly, I think the bad science and yellow journalism could go on for a long time because the authors were not available for critical questioning. Thankfully, nowadays, news production and news consumption, information putting out there and consumption is becoming more and more interactive through interactive medium. And people love it, people like it. So, keeping that in mind, what would you say if I say that both scientists and science journalists are ethically responsible to be available for critical questioning? What would you say about that?
Okay, we'll answer that in a minute. There are a couple of questions back
Thank
here.
Thank you. I'm Zabi from Jordan, science advisor to the Interaction Council. History of science, I think history of science is a grossly underutilized source to get answers to many of the questions that were raised here this afternoon. The logarithm or algorithms that were talked about actually belonged to the guy by the name of Al-Khwarizmi, who lived in Baghdad in the 9th century. So we're talking about a gentleman who lived 1300 years ago and mentioning his name in a different context. I think the value of history of science can be a positive influence on the way we perceive science and practice science. It tells us that science is universal and transnational, and a scientific discovery in one civilization or country or culture would eventually become a universal asset that we all utilize. That's critically important to realize today in this age of populism and ultra-nationalism and so on and so forth. Secondly, very quickly, I think academies of sciences are also a grossly underutilized source of information for science journalists, for the public, on science and the value of science as a means to achieve socioeconomic development. And after all, we are in the majestic presence of a great Academy of Sciences, and we're discussing this. So I would appreciate if at some point within the narrative that you talked about, we can revisit these two issues again and perhaps try and find some of the answers.
Thank you. Could I just ask you to pass the microphone behind you? And I'm afraid this will have to, there are lots of hands, but this will probably have to be the last question because we're over time. And then we'll answer these last
three.
Thank you very much. Sorry to those people whose hands were up and I didn't come to.
I will be short. I'm very glad that we started talking about harassment in research institutions, but research is not conducted only in research institutions, and we should also start talking about harassment in other organizations, especially in associations, because somehow associations usually, there are excellent examples of good association and promoting of research integrity and ethics. But there are also less known cases where harassment is applied over persons only because work in line with research integrity principles, because try to implement responsible practices to prevent misconduct. There are somehow somewhere a lot of personal interests, and I think that the journal, it may be a role of journalists to tell stories and to raise its case that harassment may exist also in association, and by telling the stories to tell people that this should be prevented.
As my children will tell you, I'm a soft touch, so I'm going to take one more from the
Thank
person
you.
With the microphone in her hand.
Just quickly, I'm a professor of medical physics at UCL, but I also spent some time working at the Financial Times as a journalist. So I was on both sides of this. And I know exactly what you mean. When I was interviewing scientists, as a secondary journalist, I wanted the soundbite. I wanted the thing that would be the hook for the audience. But as scientists, we're not trained in soundbites, and we're not trained to think about the narrative, the story of our science for a public audience. We're telling the story often to our peers. And I think there's an underestimation of the lack of training that scientists have, but also the recognition that those activities have within a university system. You don't get promoted if you have a piece published in the FT that might go to 11 million readers. You get published if your papers are written and your grants are written. And I think there's a hidden subtext here. Lots of science communication in STEM subjects is done by women, and it's seen as a soft area of activity. And women are therefore not given as much time to write the grants and the papers because they're doing the schools outreach programs, they're doing the women in science talks, they're doing the communication. And then we wonder why there's a gender pay gap, because the promotion criteria requires us to be recognized on the basis of all of the grants and the papers that our male colleagues are writing while we're doing the other work. And I think that that's not being given sufficient profile at the moment.
The next session is going to be on ethics of reward and recognition then, is it?
So that was a huge range of subjects. I don't know if anyone wants to pick up on any of those things. Sorry, we really...
Please, just one last comment. I just wanted to know the ethical implications of the journalist. The journalists control the scientists, but who controls the journalist in their ethical values about the sensationalism and other things? Who controls if their, you know, their conduct, and who can actually stop the fake news and the alternative facts from appearing? Thank you.
I think that's a subject for a whole other conference, actually. But if anyone wants to pick up on any of these things, then please do.
I guess in a way, if there's some fake news, or like the news, the sensational news, we can't stop them, frankly speaking. But I think as a scientist, you can't deny the fact that you have to go into those channels and actually counteract some of those things, right? That's one of the jobs that actually I'm trying to do in my home country. Because no way on earth that you can stop any bad news, fake news, and whatever news they have. Okay, and actually, I don't even get paid to write a publication in any newspaper. I'm a full professor, and my colleagues asking me, why the hell are you doing that? But I said, this is my passion. I want to actually doing it. Thank you.
So as an academic, I've spoken with many science journalists, and I've sort of experienced both sides, where there's some science, some journalists who have said, no, you can't see, you know, the final product, and others who share with me. And so either I'm okay with it either way. So there's sort of, but there's one thing that some journalists have done, which I thought was really helpful. Basically, they've given it to me, and they sort of said, the only thing you can change are sort of if I got some facts wrong. And I thought that was very helpful. That was so there was a sort of prior agreement. You can't change anything else, but you can, if there's a factual mistake, please correct that. And I thought that was fair. So I don't know what you guys think, but.
Yeah, I've certainly done that in my book writing. When I have chapters which are very long, I've sent little chunks of sentences with facts and said, you can suggest corrections to the facts if they're incorrect, but they're only suggestions and they're only to the facts, and that's it. And people are generally willing to accept that. I did have a big argument once with a guy who invented a new kind of microscope, and I wrote a profile of him for Science, and he called me on the phone because I wouldn't share the copy with him. It's a profile of him as a person, so it's really... It had to be a bit critical as well as, you know, reflective on his work. And he shouted at me and said, it's my story. And I said, no, actually it isn't. It's my story. And I think that's what I think scientists have to understand. The story does not belong to you. It belongs to us, and we're writing on behalf of the public. And in fact, because he was refusing to engage with me and correct any of the facts, one of the numbers that he gave me was wrong, and we had to print a correction afterwards because he wouldn't then engage with me. And then a week later, after talking to his colleagues, he apologized.
I've just been informed that if people do have more questions, we're going to continue in the concert hall. There's a press point, and you're welcome to that straight after this session. So I'm going to ask each of our speakers to say in one sentence, what is it, the one thing that you would like people to take away from this session, and then we have to wrap up.
Okay, I'll start. So I wanted to also underline that you can talk to journalists about your concerns about how they represent you. So, and you can do that in many ways. I think sort of asking to check facts, or you know, like I can just send you the facts that I put in bits. There are ways. So don't be afraid to ask to not negotiate, but you know, ask if you're worried. I have many things to say, but.
So I'm going to take us back to the theme of the session about ethics of science communication, and back to this point that I closed my presentation on. I would really like to encourage you to think about the fact that doing science, part and parcel of doing science, or doing research more broadly, is communicating it. So you don't, and whether you do it to the public, whether you do it to your colleague down the corridor in the institute where you work, or whether you do it at a scientific conference, all of that is communication, and that is part of what you do as you do research. So when you think about research ethics, part and parcel of that is thinking about communication ethics.
So my last message is that when you try to communicate science, it's a very difficult topic, and people actually have been arguing for the longest time. But again, I think the lack of that is actually going to be the beneficial if you actually start to understand an art and science of how to communicate proficiently and effectively. And I guess with that, hopefully one day people will understand the process of science, the trust in science, and trust in good scientists, because there are some bad scientists as well. Thank you.
Well, I would just say that, again, going back to the theme of this ethics and responsibility, the problem that we have with the way the science is done at the moment is that there are people with disproportionate power. And I think this is what it goes back to ultimately again and again, which is that the structures and incentives around the production of science are not conducive to good practice always. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. And perhaps we need to rethink the structures.
So my last comment is, I think a lot of the science that's being communicated have ethical implications. And I think it's important to for the scientists to recognize that, what they do have broader implications for the society, and to try to understand what those implications are. And so they have a responsibility to both share that knowledge in a truthful way, but also to communicate that.
So thank you. For me, what this session shows me is that this is an area ripe for discussion. We could have gone on for hours, but unfortunately we can't. So please join me in thanking our keynote speaker and our fantastic panel. Thank you.